Welcome to the debate. Imagine sitting in a dark doorway in New York City. Your breathing is heavy. You are finally safe from a brutal attacker.
Right.
But then you look down and you realize your palm is deeply sliced open and you're clutching a locker key that you have absolutely no memory of picking up.
It's a terrifying scenario.
It really is. Did you consciously choose to survive? Or did your ancestors' trauma just sort of hijack your nervous system to save your life?
Are you the pilot of your own body or, you know, just a passenger strapped in for a ride designed by generations of violence you never even directly experienced?
Exactly. And that incredibly murky, fascinating territory is exactly where we find ourselves today. We are exploring Hulke Oak and Tabak's novel, Vera.
Right. And we're looking at the profound tension at the very core of the protagonist's existence, the conflict between conscious agency and inherited determinism.
Yes. The source material forces us to ask, does Vera actively choose her incredibly dangerous path through a global espionage network, or is she fundamentally driven by the inescapable gravity of intergenerational trauma?
Because the text presents us with a woman whose physical body and psychological state are, well, constantly reacting to a deeply buried past.
A heavy past.
Very heavy. It's anchored by her grandmother Oksana's missing 1971 Moscow monograph and this overarching ledger of historical suffering that dates all the way back to the forced famines of 1932 in Kharkiv.
Exactly. And when I read this, I see a woman who is entirely in control of her destiny. I represent the perspective that Vera is defined by her sovereign, calculated agency.
Really?
Yes, really. Despite the overwhelming weights of her family's history, we see her actively, deliberately reclaiming her own narrative.
I look at those exact same scenes and I see a ghost story. I'll be arguing the contrasting perspective today. I think Vera is propelled primarily by somatic memory and the deterministic weight of a generational burden.
A vessel, basically.
Right, a vessel. I see a woman whose body is frequently hijacked by her ancestors, acting out a history she just cannot escape.
Well, let's start right at the beginning of that journey then. From my reading, Vera's survival and her progression through this lethal landscape are rooted in hyper-conscious, deliberate choices.
Okay, where do you see that clearly?
We see this vividly during her escape in New York. When the apartment on Perry Street is breached and her TA is stabbed, she doesn't just run blindly in a panic. She consciously maps her flight.
She's running for her life, though.
She is, but she knows to avoid the new security cameras on Green Street. She deliberately utilizes bodega back doors to lose her pursuers. And crucially, rather than fleeing to the safety of her mother,
who is frantically texting her,
right, driving down from upstate, instead of going to her, Vera actively chooses to pursue the mystery of the locker key, locker number 47 at the Port Authority. She steps willingly into the geopolitical crosshairs.
To get the photo.
To retrieve that photograph of herself in the velvet dress, along with her grandmother's note reading, "Do not forget." To me, she is claiming the agency to uncover the truth.
I hear you on her ability to navigate the city, but look at it through a different lens for a second. Vera is navigating a labyrinth built by her ancestors, and she is driven by reflexes that bypass her conscious mind entirely.
You don't think dodging cameras is conscious?
You mentioned her escape in New York, but look closely at the mechanics of that scene in the text. Vera literally does not remember picking up that locker key at the apartment on Perry Street. Her hand simply remembered how to survive. The key was in her fist, her knuckles white, before her conscious brain even registered taking it.
It is a striking detail.
It is, and it's paired with that ever-present internal command, keep your face still. This isn't a conscious tactical choice she sits down and makes in the moment.
It's ingrained.
Exactly. The text explicitly notes it. It is an embedded survival mechanism dating back to her childhood. It proves she is operating on inherited trauma rather than free will. Her reality is dictated by things done to her.
Even physically?
Yes. I have to admit, when I read the part about the yellow-green bruise on her inner thigh dictating how she shifts her weight on the subway, I actually found myself shifting my own weight in my chair.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a brilliant way to show trauma as a physical manifestation of violence acting upon her. She's not the driver. She is a passenger in her own body.
But let's dig into the actual biology and psychology of that physical flight in New York, because the mechanics of how she survives are central to what we're debating here.
Sure.
How do you view those moments where she seems entirely disconnected from her own actions?
I think the physical dissociation Vera experiences during that New York attack is profound evidence for determinism. The text constantly emphasizes that her body acts completely independently of her intellect.
Right. Like after the attack?
Yeah. After she swings the heavy glass lamp at the attacker, she discovers cuts and blood on her own body only after the fact. She sits in a doorway on Bleecker Street and suddenly notices a deep cut on her palm from the glass.
Right.
She didn't feel it happen. When she gets home to her apartment on East 7th, she looks at the blood in the shower and the shirt she is wearing, and she tells herself, "I am holding a key I did not pick up. I am wearing a shirt I did not put on."
That line always gives me chills.
Because it highlights a terrifying psychological fracture. She is entirely disconnected from her actions. Her biology takes over to ensure survival, making her an automaton carrying out genetic imperatives.
Genetic imperatives, you think?
Neurologically speaking, yes. When a human is in mortal danger, the brain literally shuts down the prefrontal cortex, which handles logical thought and conscious decision-making, and hands the keys entirely to the amygdala, the fear center.
Right. The fight-or-flight response.
Exactly. Her body hasn't been told the difference between what is happening now in New York and what happened to her grandmother in the past. She is a passenger to her own trauma responses.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how the brain operates under pressure. What you are characterizing as trauma-induced dissociation might actually be a highly evolved strategic intuition.
How can it be strategic if her prefrontal cortex is offline and she isn't consciously aware she's doing it?
Well, think of a speed chess grandmaster. To a novice observer, or even to us, it looks like they're just slapping pieces down on the board on pure thoughtless instinct.
Because they're moving so quickly.
Right. They are moving way too fast for conscious deliberation. But neurologically, they aren't just guessing or panicking. They are accessing tens of thousands of hours of conscious study in a microsecond.
Pattern recognition?
Exactly. Their brain has chunked all that information into instant pattern recognition. That's Vera in New York. The text points out that she perfectly executes survival protocols she has honed through years of walking New York at night after her restaurant shifts.
So you're saying the mapping of the streets wasn't accidental?
Not at all. Her body doesn't just react blindly. It executes a hyper-specific flight path, Mercer to Bleecker to East 7th, because she deliberately mapped this territory over years.
Okay, but what about the cut palm?
Noticing the cut on her palm later isn't a lack of agency. It is a neurological phenomenon. In high-stakes survival, the brain actively prioritizes cognitive bandwidth.
By suppressing pain?
Yes, it suppresses pain signals, literally blocking the neurotransmitters from the cut palm to redirect blood flow and processing power to the legs and the eyes. She suspends pain to prioritize tactical survival. That isn't her being a zombie. That is calculated agency operating at lightning speed.
It's a compelling way to frame expertise, I'll give you that. But I'm just not convinced that applies here. Let me tell you why.
Go ahead.
A chess grandmaster still makes the sovereign decision to sit down at the board. They opt into the game. Vera's body is making choices she is actively confused and terrified by.
Terrified, sure, but...
And the narrative structure itself supports this. In those moments, the text shifts into the second person. You are running. It purposefully creates a distance between the narrator and the action to highlight this ancestral override.
Wait, you think the syntax itself is pointing to a lack of agency?
Absolutely. Her grandmother Oksana survived the terror of 1932 Kharkiv, where oppressors literally reduced living, breathing villages to numbers on a line. That specific desperate survival reflex was passed down in the blood.
Somatic memory.
Yes. When Vera is on the subway, her skin is described as being alive in a way skin is not supposed to be when you are afraid. That isn't cognitive bandwidth prioritization. That is somatic memory. The body remembers the famine, even if the mind wasn't there.
Okay, let's follow that exact thread. The historical ledger of Kharkiv. because it scales up dramatically. It's one thing for her body to intuitively dodge a physical attacker in an alley in New York.
Right.
It's entirely different when she steps into the TomTom Mahalisi apartment in Istanbul and makes a conscious geopolitical power play. Let's look at how that instinct scales up from physical survival to espionage.
I come at it from a different way. I actually think Istanbul proves my point even more.
Really?
Yeah. In Istanbul, she is even more of a pawn. She is literally moved around a board by older operators like Yelena and Emery. Yelena tells her where to go. Emery holds the documents.
But she's the one carrying it out.
1971 Moscow monograph. Emery hands Vera a brown envelope with six names, five dead, and her grandmother's blank date.
The blank date is such a heavy detail.
It is the ultimate symbol of what she's caught in. She isn't an active agent orchestrating an operation. She's simply balancing a historical ledger that began in 1932.
The famine.
Right. The text explicitly takes us to that horrific moment in Kharkiv where a child is watching her grandmother count seized grain. 36, 35, 34. The village is reduced to a mathematical subtraction.
True.
Essentially, Vera is not the one driving the car here. She's just in the passenger seat, paying off a toll her grandmother incurred 90 years ago. She is carrying the blank date of her grandmother to close out that terrible arithmetic. She is an instrument of the ledger.
That's a fascinating way to summarize the generational debt. That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Because I think you are looking entirely at the setup of that scene and ignoring the crucial pivot.
What pivot?
Let's look at the actual moment in Emery's apartment. Before the raid occurs, the older operators are arguing about whether to publish the documents and risk being killed. They are paralyzed by the weight of the history.
Right, they're hesitant.
And what does Vera do? She actively interrupts them. She demands a copy of the documents from Emery. She states out loud to a room of seasoned spies that she is going to Prague to find the missing monograph. She claims the mission.
But she's claiming a mission that was pre-assigned to her bloodline. It was already hers.
I disagree on the intention behind it. Taking that document is Vera's absolute refusal to be a passive entry in the oppressor's ledger. Think about the difference in posture.
How so?
It is the fundamental difference between having history inflicted upon you, like the child silently watching her grandmother's thumb press the dough while armed men take their food, and actively demanding the pen to write the history yourself.
Demanding the pen?
Yes. When she folds that envelope and puts it inside her jacket against her ribs, she is stepping out of the role of the pawn. She feels the weight of the toll, and she consciously decides to pay it on her own terms.
Is she paying it on her own terms, though? Look at where she places the envelope. She puts it against her ribs right next to the photograph her grandmother left in the locker and right next to the pencil note given to her by Joe the bartender.
She's keeping them safe.
She is literally swathed in the instructions of the dead and the older generation. Even when she escapes the ensuing raid in Istanbul, carrying a bleeding Yelena down the stairs of Kumbarachi Yokushu, how does she know where to go?
She uses the app.
Exactly. She is guided by a notification from an app on her phone that she didn't even install. It is safer to go east, the message says. She is being directed by invisible hands. She is on a track she cannot step off of.
Which brings us perfectly to the ultimate metaphor for being on a track, the Trans-Siberian Railway. It allows us to explore how she reclaims her physical and psychological space while in extreme, literal confinement.
Confinement is the perfect word. The Trans-Siberian train is the ultimate architectural metaphor for her lack of free will.
You see it as a cage?
She is literally confined to iron tracks laid by previous generations between 1891 and 1916. She is moving east to go west, trapped in the physical infrastructure of the very empire that hunted her grandmother. She cannot outrun her lineage, no matter how much she tries to claim agency.
How so? The train is just a mode of transport.
But look at who finds her on it. We see the inescapability explicitly when she is haunted on the train by Adrian Lenz, the man with the comma scar on his thumb, who quotes Shakespeare to her in perfect, classroom-learned Russian.
Right. He tracks her.
He does. And even more devastatingly, an older Ukrainian woman in the corridor recognizes her face. A total stranger looks at her, calls her by her ancestral name, Vera, and says she lost her granddaughter.
It's a powerful scene.
It proves Vera cannot hide.
Her face is a literal map of her ancestry. She is wearing her grandmother's ghost.
She is recognized, yes, but how does she process that recognition? That's where the agency lies.
Well, the text uses a quote Vera recalls from W.H. Auden, "For the error bred in the bone." This perfectly encapsulates the biological, inescapable mechanics of her inherited burden. The error is in the bone. It's genetic determinism.
Genetic determinism.
Yeah. As she rides that train, the text notes that every hour the train moves, some of her is left behind in the motion. She is being consumed by the geography of her grandmother's trauma. Her identity is dissolving into the tracks.
I hear your point on the sheer geographical weight she is carrying, but I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because you are entirely ignoring how Vera actively uses her body as the ultimate site of reclamation against that very trauma.
Reclamation?
Yes. We have to bring in the evidence from the 2025 Berlin flashback to understand how she pushes back. Let's look at the Kreuzberg basement.
Ah, the tattoo scene.
Yes. Vera goes down into a cold concrete room, sits on a chair with a short leg under a humming 40-watt bulb, and deliberately inks a line under her "Not Me" tattoo. She meticulously orchestrates her own pain.
But the tattoo itself, "Not Me," is a defensive posture. It's a reaction to the trauma of being identified as a grandmother. It's a denial, not a creation.
A reaction, yes, but the physical act of underlining it is an assertion of control. Let's look at the mechanics of what she is doing.
She's tattooing herself.
Yes, and the text details her dipping the needle, touching the skin, wiping the ink. It describes it as small, sustained decisions made one after the other by a hand that is doing a thing.
Right.
Dunno life where violence has always been inflicted upon her body by outside forces, you know, the attackers, the bruises, the cuts. She is now the one wielding the needle. She is physically altering the canvas of her body, controlling the pain receptors to declare her separation from the trauma.
You think controlling the pain is a way of reclaiming the body?
Exactly. And furthermore, on that Siberian train, she isn't just a trapped victim consumed by geography. She actively chooses to spend the night with the Dutch photographer, Peter.
An encounter she initiates precisely because she is disoriented and terrified by Adrian Lenz and the Ukrainian woman recognizing her. It's a trauma response to seek comfort.
But she initiates it to ground herself in the present. She uses her sexual agency to insist on her own aliveness. It is a stark contrast to the ghosts surrounding her.
Grounding herself? Okay.
Yes, after they are together, she lies awake and thinks to herself, "I chose that. I do not know what I just did. I know I chose it." She then leaves on her own terms with a deliberate note of thanks.
Leaving a note, yes.
Her self-inflicted tattoo and her sexual agency are not the actions of a trapped vessel. They are the sovereign declarations of a woman insisting that her body belongs to her alone. She is actively transforming inherited pain into a self-authored identity.
I genuinely appreciate how you frame the tattoo and the encounter with Pieter as attempts at self-authorship. But look at what happens at the end of the line. She arrives in Vladivostok.
Right.
She walks down to the harbor where Nina, the woman who tried to bring her the documents, was found dead in the water. Vera puts her hands on the cold green painted railing.
And she realizes the futility.
She realizes the futility of it all. She realizes that the missing Moscow folder isn't there. The truth she was chasing doesn't exist in a tangible way. She says, "I know what my grandmother left behind."
A dead end.
Exactly. Her supposed agency led her to a dead end dictated by the past. The city doesn't know anything. The water doesn't know anything. She is standing at the edge of the Pacific Ocean, entirely defined by the ghost she was chasing.
But notice the physical action she takes immediately after that realization. She doesn't jump into the water. She takes her hands off the rail. She turns her back to the harbor, and she walks up the hill.
Just turning away.
The text says, "I have been east. I am going west. I am 23 and I am walking up a hill. And the body has been east and the body is going west." She acknowledges the immense geographical and historical journey she was compelled to take, but the physical turning away from the water is the ultimate choice. She is deciding the next direction.
Deciding to go west is just completing the circuit her grandmother started. Her grandmother went west from the Soviet Union. Now Vera is going west from Vladivostok. It's the illusion of choice within a predetermined cyclical track.
As we step back to look at the entire narrative arc, we've explored two vastly different ways to read Vera's journey. My position remains that Vera's deliberate actions, from strategically mapping her high-speed flight through the back doors of New York, to boldly claiming the historical documents in Istanbul, to the profound agency of tattooing her own skin in Berlin, demonstrate a fierce intellectual and physical agency. She refuses to be merely written by the past.
And I maintain that Vera's somatic responses, her reflexive survival instincts that bypass her conscious brain entirely, and her literal confinement to the iron tracks of her grandmother's unfinished mission highlight the overwhelming deterministic power of generational trauma. She's a profound character precisely because she illustrates how human beings can become vessels for history, carrying ledgers we didn't write and paying tolls we didn't incur.
Yet amidst this fundamental disagreement over who is driving the car, there is a profound point of convergence here. We both completely agree that Vera's physical body is the primary landscape where historical violence and modern survival collide.
Absolutely. The physical manifestations in this novel are the ultimate text. The yellow-green bruise on her thigh, changing color as it dictates her posture. The unnoticed cut on her palm from the glass lamp. The stinging ink of the tattoo needle in the Kreuzberg basement. The deep, bone-level exhaustion of the Trans-Siberian train ride. The body itself is the ledger where all of these forces, both chosen and inherited, are tallied.
And I think the brilliance of Hulki Okantabuk's Vera lies exactly in this ambiguity. It asks us to consider a deeply uncomfortable question. Is fully accepting an inherited burden a submission to the past, or is taking ownership of that burden the ultimate act of free will?
It is a beautiful complexity that demands multiple readings to fully appreciate. You simply can't look at a protagonist's physical actions without understanding the invisible historical weight pressing down on their every step.
We highly encourage you to explore the material yourselves. Go walk the steep, treacherous streets of Istanbul and ride the rattling carriages of the Trans-Siberian alongside Vera and form your own conclusions.
There is so much to uncover in those pages.
Because much like that physical reflex we discussed at the start, a map of our past might bypass our conscious brain entirely, and the trauma might be written deeply into our very biology. But the question remains, once our hand pulls away from the fire, who decides where we walk next?